today's topic is hardly a topic to begin the day with, you know. The Warren Report. Truth or cover-up. But it's one of the most important topics because I know that after the assassination took place and then when we got to the nominating convention in San Francisco and went through the election, I had mentioned to other audiences, I said, between the election, that is the nominating convention and all of the things that happened there, and the assassination, with all the information that was available to us through those two events, we would have just about all the information we would ever need to put together the complete picture of the conspiracy that controlled our country, because I think that in the assassination they had to virtually pull all the levers, and it was certainly not too difficult to see where the levers were concerned. And that was also true of the election, that is, of the nomination, for what was going on in the Republican Party and the reaction to it after San Francisco. So these two events have given us enormous amount of information. They have also given us a good idea of who are the people who are doing the things that are being done. But it seems that a lot of people are just, let's see, Warren Report is being forgotten, and the assassination is being forgotten very quickly. That I know that it lingers in the minds of many people, but since the Warren Commission decided that there was no conspiracy, the right has sort of figured, well, let's not, you know, get too much into that, because, well, they haven't accused us, so we'll go on to the next great event. But I knew that the surrounding the assassination, these events would occur. I didn't know to what degree, but I knew that there was would be a great deal of interest in this relation coming up here. And I can assure you that what has been published in the simple report, is a simple one-volume report, is just a drop of what came out in the entire and all of the hearings, which were published in, I guess, 26 volumes at a cost of $74. But, I understand they printed 3,000 sets of those 24 volumes. And I wish there were more of those sets getting into right-wing hands, at least into our hands, because they have some valuable information. Because the way they were edited, you see, when they created this book, they only out of the testimony those tidbits that they wanted that would fit in with their theories. But the vast residue of information is there. The vast the tonnage of it is there. And so make sure that your libraries get that set. That, because I'm just worried about whether how many of them will be burned in a very short time. Anyway, I prepared a bit of a text, so I'll read it to you. Warren Report. No one would dispute the fact that the publication of the Warren Report has not cleared the air concerning the strange circumstances of President Kennedy's assassination. Although it is likely that many people will accept and be perfectly satisfied with the official conclusion of the commission, that there was no conspiracy, vast numbers of Americans, among whom I include myself, find the commission's conclusion unacceptable. Mr. Harrison Salisbury of the New York Times calls us theory mongers. That's a new word, isn't it? Of course, and the reason why we are theory mongering, he tells us in his introduction to the report, he wrote the introduction to this edition, is because, quote, there is in each of our hearts some feeling, however small, of responsibility. Some feeling that each of us had some share in the crime because we had a role in a society which made it possible, which gave birth to a young man who by a long, dreary, painful path became distorted into an assassin, unquote. Well, I've got news from Mr. Salisbury. I don't have the slightest feeling of responsibility at all for anything Oswald became or did. Of course, Mr. Salisbury should feel some responsibility. After all, he has been misinforming the American people for years, and he belongs to the very establishment which has made it so easy for the Oswalds to operate. The New York Times, which was Castro's most potent ally, has blood on its hands, and it would like to share this blood with the rest of us. Well, I and millions of other patriotic Americans will not buy this hogwash about collective guilt. Let the collectivists wallow in their guilt, since they are collectivists. But we individualists hold ourselves responsible for our own actions only. Collective guilt is as alien to the American way of life as is communism itself. It is a transparent attempt to evade the job of finding and identifying the real perpetrators of the crime. Now, there is no substitute for individual judgment. Collectivists, like Mr. Salisbury, are willing to accept the conclusions of the Warren Commission because, obviously, they have no independent means of judging the facts for themselves. They prefer to take without question what is handed down to them by the authorities. It reminds one very much of the Soviet Presidium, which decides what is true and what is false, regardless of the facts of reality, and hands it down to the people who have no choice about accepting it or not. In the first place, they are denied the facts on which any independent judgment can be based, and in the second, they know what's good for them if they dare question the judgment of the authority. In the United States, a measure of freedom we still maintain can be gauged by how the Warren Commission had to actually go through the process of gathering facts, testimonies, and evidence. The measure of our people's real concern for freedom will be in how we deal with those facts. Whether we just let them sit in the books and do nothing about them, or go over them with a fine-tooth comb and uncover what really happened on November 22, 1963 in Dallas. Of course, there is the risk of being stigmatized as a theory monger by Mr. Salisbury or an extremist by Mr. Larson. But that's a very small risk for the moment. There may be other less publicized risks involved, but this nation was not built by men who were afraid to take risks, and it will not be preserved by men unwilling to take risks. Risk-taking has now become the condition for our survival, and every patriotic American knows this. Now, if we set aside the Harrison Salisbury's, we find that the rest of us interested in the assassination can be divided into two groups. The communists and their many dupes who have been taken in by the incredible fabrications of Radio Moscow, Mark Lane, and other left-wing spokesmen, and those citizens who are convinced that Oswald was a communist agent and the assassination a deliberate and carefully planned act of the communist conspiracy. Since I am concerned primarily in proving the validity of this last thesis, let me first examine the communist thesis, that President Kennedy was murdered by a right-wing conspiracy. The motive behind this communist accusation is obvious. The communists often accuse their opponents of the things they themselves do. In addition, since there were so many indications that there was some kind of conspiracy at work, the communists have had to fabricate some kind of a story by which these telltale clues could be explained. For example, the communists knew that many people would be puzzled by Oswald getting his passport so quickly in New Orleans in June 1963. How could a defector to the communists, who had turned over military secrets to the Soviet secret police and was still active in pro-communist activities on his return here, how could a man like that get a passport issued to him within merely 24 hours, particularly since he had written on the application that he intended to travel to the Soviet Union? Well, the communists knew that this could be interpreted as meaning that Oswald, with his notorious red record, was getting favorable treatment in the State Department, which would lead any thinking person to the conclusion that the State Department was in some measure controlled by communists or communist sympathizers. Now, the last thing the communists want the American people to realize is to what degree the communists actually control our government in Washington. Evidence of this control and influence is so rampant in the circumstances of the president's assassination, that the communists have had to concoct some pretty far-fetched stories to explain away this evidence. So in the case of the passport, they contend that Oswald must have been working for the CIA in some anti-communist capacity in order to have rated such special treatment. The Warren Report tells us that Oswald's passport was processed routinely, which is pretty preposterous since anyone going to the Soviet Union gets special attention, I hope. Those of us, however, who know to what extent anti-communists are actually harassed in the State Department have no trouble understanding how Oswald, a defector to the Soviet Union, could be given special consideration. The Otto Otepka affair and the recent removal of 7 well-known anti-communists from the security section of the State Department is a good indication of the power the pro-communists have over the anti-communists in that department. But the left-wingers and dupes who read Mark Lane or listen to his lectures are usually so ignorant of such basic facts that they accept almost any nonsense Mr. Lane tells them. This speaker attended one of Mark Lane's lectures to the general public. The impression Lane tried to give was that Oswald had been framed by a right-wing conspiracy, which had indeed committed the crime. He didn't venture any farther than this. He didn't offer a plausible outline of this right-wing plot, who might have conceived it, how it was carried out, and for what reason. But he left no doubts in the minds of his audience that all the so-called evidence pointed in that direction. Significantly, during the question and answer period, a young lady got up and said that she could accept the idea of a racist plot against the president, but she could not accept the complicity of the United States government in such a plot, which, of course, is the crucially weak point in the entire communist-inspired thesis. In order to accept the thesis that President Kennedy was killed by a right-wing conspiracy, you must also accept the only logical conclusion that one can draw from that thesis, that this right-wing conspiracy is being protected from exposure not only by the Warren Commission, whose head was chosen on the recommendation of the communists themselves, but by President Johnson, the FBI, the CIA, the Dallas authorities, and the entire United States press. Now, there is nothing the establishment would like better than to pin the murder of Kennedy on the right wing. And so you would have to be a complete moron to accept the notion that the establishment is withholding or covering up the evidence they wished existed. Of course, the average left-winger rarely bothers himself about facts. He will just about accept anything he is told by a left-wing authority. It is this kind of slavish and slovenly mentality which is characteristic of the left-winger, combined with a fanatic insistence that he is right, although his mind never begins to separate fact from fiction. The left-winger rejects the mind as a precise instrument for knowing reality. For if you accept your mind as being perfectly capable of knowing reality, then you are an individual, and that is something a collectivist, by definition, is incapable of being. Now, what is it about the Warren Report which makes it impossible to accept its conclusion that there was no conspiracy? Well, first we must begin with the government's very prejudicial attitude towards the happening in Dallas. This prejudgment was exercised as soon as the news came over the wire before any inquiry was even started. The first such prejudicial announcement was the Voice of America broadcast, which blamed the right wing for the crime before the suspects had been caught. The second prejudicial announcement came after the suspected assassin had been caught and identified as a defector who had lived in the Soviet Union, and the State Department sent Khrushchev, this is immediately after Oswald was caught, a few hours, the State Department sent Khrushchev a note of assurance telling him that everything was all right and that we were still the best of friends. Since this assurance was given before any inquiry had been made, we must assume that the United States government decided that the identification of those guilty for the murder of our president was less important than keeping Nikita Khrushchev happy. In other words, it was obvious by the way our government responded from the very beginning that an objective investigation of the murder would be out of the question. It then became the purpose of the Warren Commission to produce a report which would confirm the government's prejudged version that Oswald was a twisted loner, in league with no one, and that he in turn was murdered by another loner equally psychotic in motivation. This does not mean that the Warren Report does not contain the facts. It contains them by the ton. But how it assesses, appraises, and weighs and connects these facts with other facts is the area in which the report leaves itself wide open. As an example of the Warren Commission's bias, let's take the subject of Oswald's finances. As you know, after Oswald was caught, the authorities discovered $13.87 on his person and a wallet at his home with $170. Since Oswald was known to be an exceptionally low-wage earner, the question which immediately arose was, how did Oswald manage to accumulate this cash? Had he been paid money from some undisclosed source? You know, he had also gone to Mexico and spent some money there. Well, the Warren Commission decided to show how it could be possible for Oswald to have had this money without receiving it from an unknown source. And in Appendix 14 of the report, we find an analysis of Lee Harvey Oswald's finances from June 13, 1962 through November 22, 1963. And I just want to take it up with you in this book and go over it with you to show you how they bent over backwards to make this theory stick, because you'll see very shortly. Now here it is, you see they have the complete tabulation of his month by month expenditures. Now he and his wife and child arrived in the United States on June 13th, 1962. So for the month of June 1962, they give you his expenditures. That on hand on arrival in New York, he had $63, received from his brother, Robert Oswald, $200, received from Marguerite Oswald, his mother, $10. Gives you a total of $273 for the month of June. Now, what did he spend it on? The transportation in New York City, $10.35. Plane fare to Dallas, $201. Hotel bill, $15.21. Estimated cost of food, clothing, and incidental expenses, that is for the entire month of June, $5. Public stenographer, $10. Estimated repayment of the loan to his brother, $30. In other words, he had $30 to pay back to his brother, but only $5 to spare for food, clothing, and everything else. And guess how much cash on hand he had at the end of the month? $1.40. So you see, they estimate that he couldn't possibly have spent more than $5. And so they give you a balance, $1.40. Well, let's take the next month, July 1962. Net salary for that month, $46.82, you see. Now, what are his expenditures for the entire month of July 1962? Estimated repayment to Robert Oswald, his brother, $10. And a subscription to Time magazine for $3.87. That's all they have down here for his expenditures for the month of July 1962. Cash on hand, they give him a balance at the end of the month of $34.35. The man didn't buy a hot dog that month, he didn't take a bus, he didn't buy a newspaper, nothing, you see. Just a subscription to Time magazine, and I think Time ought to use that as a great, you know, ad for getting subscribers. Think of it, you know, Oswald deprived his family of everything just to get a subscription to Time. Isn't that incredible? The next month, August 1962, his net salary was $207.31. Of course, they always bring over the balance of the last month. That's the way they begin to accumulate the balances. $207.31, and his expenditures for that month, $10 for his State Department loan repayment, repayment to Robert Oswald of $50, rent and utilities, $71.50. That is, he moved into a house at that time, so they had to put something in there. And a subscription for the worker, $2. Oh, no, and then they also have the estimated cost of food, clothing, and incidental expenses, $75. So up to August, the month of August, he'd only spent $5 on food, clothing, and incidentals. Incredible, isn't it? Well, of course, his expenditures are equally as ridiculous as they go on through this period. And they managed to come out with a balance of $183.87 at the end, which is very close to how much he should have had. Even with their figuring out, they can only account for $164.10. And so they found on him $20 more than they expected. But you see how they finagled and twisted this thing. And if you dare to question their accounting, you're called a theory monger. The Salisbury, you see. They expect Americans to accept this as accounting as ridiculous. Obviously, he was getting money from some source, even say it was even from his mother, whatever it was, or maybe it was from friends, but it was assumed that he didn't spend a penny in the entire month of July for anything except a subscription to Time magazine is utterly ridiculous. Another instance of the commission's bias is in its investigation of the circumstances surrounding Oswald's speedy issuance of a passport in June 1963. Now, here was a man who had defected to the Soviet Union, handed over military secrets to the Soviet secret police, had returned to the United States, married to the niece of a KGB colonel. That is, a colonel of their equivalent of the FBI or the CIA, you know, their entire espionage branch. And was now applying for a new passport in order to travel to the Soviet Union. You would expect that a passport application from such an individual would at least be investigated before a passport was issued. Wouldn't you? I mean, such an application came to the desk of the State Department. You would expect them to at least stop for a moment and look at it. But Oswald was issued a passport in 24 hours, and no one had looked at Oswald's file. This is what they found out. No one looked at Oswald's file. Now, the commission justifies this procedure as being perfectly legal, normal, and routine, and not so much as criticized the State Department for its lax behavior, although the FBI was severely criticized for not having known about Oswald's intentions of assassinating the president. And that's very odd indeed, because you would have thought that they would chastise the State Department for being so lax. And I asked them why didn't they at least pull out this application and hold it up for a day or so and go through the file of this man who was a defector, was passing out leaflets for the Fair Play for Cuba Committee in New Orleans, was married to the niece of a KGB colonel, and was going back to the Soviet Union. But no, they did nothing about that at all. And the commission thinks this is perfectly all right. But it will criticize the FBI for not having been able to predict what was in Oswald's head, but yet when the State Department had an application of his intentions, they did nothing about that. But the commission, of course, wants to protect the State Department in this instance. Another instance of the commission's bias concerns Oswald's trip to Mexico City from September 26, 1963 until October 3, 1963. Oswald, we are told, visited the Soviet and Cuban embassies, ostensibly to obtain visas to those countries. Now, there was no reason for him to have traveled to Mexico City to obtain a Soviet visa. He had made no secret of his plans to travel to the USSR on his passport application, and so he could have contacted the Soviet embassy in the United States. As for what he did in the Cuban embassy, the commission's main source of information is a woman by the name of Senora Silvia Tirado de Duran, a Mexican national employed in the visa section of the Cuban embassy. The report describes her as follows, quote, although Senora Duran denies being a member of the Communist Party or otherwise connected with it, both Durans, that is, the woman and her husband, have been active in far left political affairs in Mexico, believe in Marxist ideology, and sympathize with the government of Fidel Castro, and Senor Duran has written articles for El Dia, a pro-communist newspaper in Mexico City, unquote. In other words, the commission's source of information for what Oswald was doing in Mexico City at the Cuban embassy was a communist, you see. And this is supposed to be taken as objective information. And you know that a trained Marxist is trained to lie whenever it's called for. And yet nobody pointed this out. Nobody bothered to question this woman's testimony. They just figured that she was so sincerely broken up over President Kennedy's assassination. As a matter of fact, they make that a point here and say that somebody actually saw her crying or something of that sort. But that's opposed to, for example, it says here, by far the most important confirmation of Senora Duran's testimony, however, has been supplied by confidential sources of extremely high reliability available to the United States and Mexico. The information from these sources establishes that her testimony was truthful and accurate in all material respects. The identities of these sources cannot be disclosed without destroying their future usefulness to the United States. That's how they get out of that one, you see. And you can imagine that these probably sources were the same sources that helped us find out that Castro was a communist about, you know, a year after he admitted it himself. But that's what this great authoritative commission relies on for its information. Another instance of the commission's bias can be found in its conclusions concerning the stories of certain witnesses. For example, several witnesses testified that they had observed Oswald practicing target shooting at the Sportsdrome rifle range in Dallas at various times from September through November of 1963. Although it certainly is common that witnesses can be mistaken, the witnesses in this case seem to be quite convincing. Yet because the commission decided that Oswald couldn't drive a car, they have concluded that all of the witnesses were mistaken. Now usually when there is a case of mistaken identity involved, the real person eventually turns up and the problem is solved. Just as when there was that photograph taken on the day of the assassination of the entrance of the textbook house where Oswald had worked, and they detected a face that looked like Oswald. Somebody came forth and said, well, that's me, that isn't Oswald, you see. And the case of mistaken identity was cleared up very simply. But here, so many people identified the man they saw as Oswald. The commission says, well, all these men are mistaken, yet the real person has never turned up. In the case of the rifle range, no one has shown up to identify himself as the person mistaken for Oswald. This is also true of the instance of the automobile demonstration. An automobile salesman in Dallas testified that he had attended a prospective customer whom he believes was Lee Harvey Oswald during 1963. Matter of fact, it was very soon before the assassination. Yet because the salesman had destroyed the only piece of evidence which would have corroborated his story, the commission decided that the salesman had attended someone else. As yet, that someone else has not shown up to straighten out matters. You would think that somebody would show up and say, well, I'm the one who was there. Let me read that section in the report here because it'll give you an idea of how they bent over backwards. 297 says, the testimony of Albert Guy Bogard has been carefully evaluated because it suggests the possibility that Oswald might have been a proficient automobile driver and during November 1963 might have been expecting funds with which to purchase a car. Bogard, formerly an automobile salesman with a Lincoln Mercury firm in Dallas, testified that in the early afternoon of November 9, 1963, he attended a prospective customer who he believes was Lee Harvey Oswald. According to Bogard, the customer, after test driving an automobile over the Stemmons Freeway at 60 to 70 miles an hour, told Bogard that in several weeks he would have the money to make a purchase. Very interesting. You know, several weeks away was the assassination. He would have the money to purchase a car. Bogard asserted that the customer gave his name as Lee Oswald, which Bogard wrote on a business card. After Oswald's name was mentioned on the radio on November 22nd, Bogard assertedly threw the card in the trash can, making the comment to co-employees that he supposed Oswald would no longer wish to buy a car. And this testimony they discounted. They said that, you're mistaken because Oswald was somewhere else. Where was he that day? They say, several persons who knew Oswald have testified that he was unable to drive, although Mrs. Payne was giving Oswald, that is the woman he had been living at his home his wife had been living, Mrs. Payne was giving Oswald driving lessons, stated that Oswald was showing some improvement by November. In other words, there's some kind of conflict here. They say he couldn't drive, yet she was giving him driving lessons. She says he was improving by November. Moreover, Oswald's whereabouts on November 9th, as testified to by Marina and Ruth Payne, would have made it impossible for him to have visited the automobile showrooms, as Mr. Bogard claimed. Well, where was he on that day, over on November 9th? And I've worked out a chronology of Oswald's movements so that I could check for myself, and what happened on that day was that Mrs. Payne had taken Oswald to the Texas Driver's License Examining Station. Now, by the time you get up to the examining station, you have to know how to drive. You're not going to take a test without knowing how to drive. And the station was closed that day. So maybe, since the station was closed and he had an itch to drive, he went to the Lincoln Mercury dealer, you see. But the reason they bend over backwards to prove or to insist that Oswald couldn't drive a car, because obviously, somewhere along the line, his having used an automobile might have been of great importance to this whole thing. But this is the kind of work the commission did. Now, a typical example of the commission's lack of follow-through is this particular item on page 708 concerning Ruby. Before I get into that, I just want to say something about the commission's lack of follow-through. There are many sections in testimony, and even in their report here, where one of the witnesses will say something, and you would expect the person who's questioning him to go to the next question, a logical question suggested by the statement made by the witness. And in many instances, there is simply no follow-up whatever. The witness might really say something just full of information, with a very definite lead somewhere, and the questioner will simply disregard and go on to something else. This is just throughout the entire testimony, all of it. You find it rampant throughout. And I'll just give you an example. On page 708, it says, quote, concerning Ruby, although Ruby denied ever being in Hawaii, there is some evidence that during the summer of 1961, he was in Honolulu seeking dancing talent. While it is unlikely that Ruby would forget the trip to Honolulu in 1961, there is no other indication that such a trip, if it occurred, had any sinister motive, unquote. Well, this is what they're saying. They're saying that there is evidence that Ruby was in Honolulu in the summer of 1961. They're also saying that Ruby denies that he was in Honolulu, that he was ever in Hawaii in 1961. Then they say, well, of course, you wouldn't forget if you went to Hawaii. And, you'd never forget a trip to Hawaii. But they say, but even though he refuses to admit that he had ever gone to Hawaii, there's nothing sinister behind his refusal to admit it. Nothing sinister at all. He just refuses to admit it. This is the kind of thing you find throughout this. Another example of failure to follow through. This appears on page 346. Let's see. And I quote, the commission has also received evidence that in April 1962, a telegram sent to Havana, Cuba, was charged to the business telephone of Earl Ruby, brother of Jack Ruby. Earl Ruby stated that he was unable to recall that telegram, but testified that he had never traveled to Cuba nor had any dealings with persons in Cuba, unquote. And that's it. The commission doesn't bother to peek into it, what was the nature of the telegram, what was the contents of the telegram, just lets it drop at that. They have evidence that a telegram to Cuba was charged to Earl Ruby's business phone, and Earl Ruby says he can't recall it, and they drop it, you see. How wonderful to face a commission like this, my heavens, they're not digging very hard for information. Another area in which the commission was sorely deficient was in its investigation of Oswald's life in Russia. For example, the report makes little to do about the fact that Oswald was on the MVD payroll. That is, he was on the payroll of the Soviet secret police. And that's on 370. I can give you their... I mean, they say these things, but, you know, it means nothing to them. For example, the Soviet authorities finally permitted Oswald to remain in their country. I'm quoting the book. No evidence has been found that they used him for any particular propaganda or other political or informational purposes. They sent him to Minsk to work in a radio and television factory as a metal worker. The Soviet authorities denied Oswald permission to attend a university in Moscow, but they gave him a monthly allowance of 700 rubles a month, in addition to his factory salary of approximately equal amount, and considerably better living quarters than those accorded to Soviet citizens of equal age and station. The subsidy, apparently similar to those sometimes given to foreigners allowed to remain in the Soviet Union, together with his salary, gave Oswald an income which he said approximated that of the director of the factory in which he worked. He was Oswald, who had never had a job in his life, you know, except, you know, a delivery boy, a messenger boy. Was in the Marines, defected to the Soviet Union, gets a job as a so-called metal worker, and he's paid, he is actually paid an income equal to that of the director of the factory. Pretty good work for, you know, I don't know how he managed that, and he also had living quarters, which were, you know, far better than anything provided for the people themselves living there. Page 250, there's even more, it's even given greater emphasis. It says, moreover, it is from Oswald's personal writings alone that the commission has learned that he received supplementary funds from the Soviet, quote, Red Cross, unquote. You see. And the Red Cross is simply a code word for the KGB. In the notes he made during the return trip to the United States, Oswald recognized that the Red Cross subsidy had nothing to do with the well-known International Red Cross. He frankly stated that the money was paid to him for having denounced the United States and that it had come from the MVD. In other words, the Red Cross is simply another word for MVD, and he was on their payroll and drawing a very high salary. Of course, then it says, the nature of Oswald's employment while in Minsk has been examined by the commission. The factory in which he worked was a large plant manufacturing electronic parts and radio and television sets. Marina Oswald has testified that he was an apprentice machinist and ground small metallic parts for radio receivers on a lathe. So far as can be determined, Oswald never straightforwardly described to anyone else in the United States exactly what his job was in the Soviet Union. The commission also accepted without question the story given by Oswald that he was merely a metal worker in a radio and television factory in Minsk and was doing nothing else. This hardly jives with a statement made by Colonel Golonuski, the Soviet defector, which was reported in the New York Journal American of March 4, 1964, as follows. I'll read you this very, very interesting item from this newspaper. Quote, even agents for the Warren Commission investigating the assassination of President Kennedy reportedly would now like to talk to Colonel Golonuski. This is because the defector has been able to supply an interesting bit of information to a congressional aide, namely the fact that there is a GRU assassin school in Minsk. The GRU is considered a key agency in the operation of worldwide Soviet espionage. After President Kennedy's assassination, the congressional aide established his third contact with Colonel Golonuski to ask him this pointed question. Quote, did the KGB operate a school for assassins, better known as Department 13 in Minsk? Unquote. This is the city where Lee Oswald spent most of his time in Russia, the city where he met and married Marina, now his widow. The colonel replied that although the KGB did not maintain a school for assassins there, the GRU, the military espionage arm, did have such an institution in Minsk. That's the end of that quotation. Why the commission did not bother to put this information into the report is something of a mystery. This particular item is not in the report itself. It did, however, acknowledge the connection of the GRU to the KGB in a footnote on page 242, which is interesting because Galinowski says it wasn't a KGB school, it was a GRU school, but in this footnote, the Warren Commission says, in describing the KGB, it says, the Committee for State Security, best known by its Russian initials KGB, is a lineal descendant of the revolutionary Cheka and has passed through numerous changes of name since 1917 with little change of function. Presently, the KGB handles all Soviet counterintelligence operations and is the instrument for various types of subversive activities. It is responsible for the internal security of the Soviet state and the safety of its leaders. In addition, it shares responsibility for foreign espionage activities with the intelligence component of the Ministry of Defense, the GRU. The KGB would have primary responsibility for keeping track of its effectors, such as Oswald. So there they show you the connection between the report itself admits and demonstrates the connection between the GRU and the KGB, yet they don't even bother to investigate the Galinowski testimony at all. Another point the report omits was referred to by Senator Richard Russell in a short item in Human Events, October 17, 1964, and I'll quote it. Senator Richard Russell, a prominent member of the Warren Commission, has shed some new light on the investigation of President Kennedy's assassination, which raises disturbing questions. Russell says the commission's verdict still leaves open the possibility a foreign country put Oswald up to the murder or that Jack Ruby was linked with Oswald. The commission found no evidence of any conspiracy, but Russell strongly emphasizes that it could not obtain all the evidence on Oswald's life in Minsk, where the former Marine sharpshooter lived from January 1960 until June 1962. Oswald's Russian-born wife, Marina, niece of a colonel in the Soviet secret police, testified that, quote, 300 Cubans were in school in Minsk, unquote, and that Oswald met with some of them. There has been much speculation that Oswald was a possible Cuban agent. I don't go along with the notion that he was a Cuban agent. He was a Soviet agent. He was a communist agent. And you don't work for Cuba or any other country. You work for the communist conspiracy. But simply the fact that there were 300 Cubans in school in Minsk there would at least lead you to think that the commission would mention that. That is not mentioned this report. Not a word about the Cubans is in the report, let alone the information pertaining to the GRU School for Assassins in Minsk. Another important and rather strange deficiency of the Warren report is that it lacks a chronology pertaining to Oswald's activities. A chronology is important in order to be able to follow Oswald's movements with accuracy. Yet the report has none at all. I went to the trouble of making up a chronology for my own use and found that it revealed a great deal more than one would expect. But perhaps that is the reason why the commission decided not to make one up. And let me give you some illustrations. This is really a very important aspect of the report, which was totally lacking, and that is a chronology of Oswald's movement. Because if you could follow his movement day by day, you see what the commission did was they spread it out throughout this volume. They broke it up in such a manner that it's virtually impossible to piece it together, you see, just from reading it. And they deliberately did that because there were certain sequences of events which were so incriminating that in order to deflect attention away from them, they had to break them up, and they did that by spreading them out throughout the report. For example, let me take the event the very first week that he arrived in the United States. Wednesday, June 13, 1962, Oswald arrived in the United States. He came in at Hoboken via the Dutch line of the Moscow. He's met at the pier by a man by the name of Spas T. Rakin of the Travelers Aid Society, who had been contacted by the State Department. Now, the State Department had asked this man to go and meet Oswald at the pier. Why, we don't know. There seems to be no I don't know why they would take be so solicitous of his well-being. Oswald, it says, had no plans to go to Fort Worth. But the welfare department in New York contacted Robert Oswald, his brother, and asked him to pay Oswald's fare back to Fort Worth, Oswald and Marina's fare to Fort Worth. All right, the very next day, they left New York and arrived in Fort Worth. That is Thursday, June 14th. He stayed at his brother's home. So you have Wednesday, Thursday, Friday was the 15th, Saturday was the 16th, Sunday was the 17th. On Monday morning, June 18th, 1962, he goes to the office of Pauline Virginia Bates, a public stenographer, and gives her a manuscript to type, an anti-Soviet manuscript to type. Very interesting. On Tuesday, June 9th, let me just read you how the commission reports this particular event. I'll go on. Let me first complete this short series, sequence. That's Monday. He goes to the stenographer. Tuesday, apparently he spends some time with the stenographer. Tuesday, the very next day, he calls Peter Gregory, a petroleum engineer who was born in Siberia, and teaches Russian at the Fort Worth Public Library. Now, how did he get Peter Gregory's name? It says here that he got Peter Gregory's name through the Employment Commission in Fort Worth. Now, nowhere does it say in this book that he actually went to the Employment Commission. Nobody in the Employment Commission has ever said, I gave Oswald Peter Gregory's name. You see. But that's how he got the Peter Gregory. Is still a mystery as far as I'm concerned. He says, he called Peter Gregory, a petroleum engineer who was born in Siberia and teaches Russian at the Fort Worth Public Library. He asked Gregory to give him a letter testifying to his ability to read and speak Russian so he could get a job as an interpreter or translator. And so Oswald goes to Gregory's office, and Gregory says he gave Oswald a test. He opened a Russian book at random. Oswald read it. And Gregory gave him a letter attesting to his ability to read and write Russian. Now, this is a very peculiar thing that happened. First of all, it's finding this guy, Peter Gregory, who was born in Siberia. And it's interesting, why did Oswald want this letter? In the first place, there's no indication that he ever looked for a job as an interpreter, even bothered to use the letter, you see. There's no follow-up whatever for his having gone there to get this letter. He never applied for a job, never looked for one in that field. And also this very strange technique of opening up a book and having someone read it at random. I don't know what that suggests to you, but it could suggest easily contact. Now, look at this. The very next day, June 20th, this is Wednesday, this Monday he had gone to the public stenographer, gave her an anti-Soviet manuscript. Tuesday he had gone to the Fort Worth Public Library and saw Peter Gregory. The next day, on Wednesday, he paid Mrs. Bates $10 for 10 completed pages. He refuses to accept her offer to type up the manuscript for nothing. He takes the manuscript back and tells her that an engineer in Fort Worth wants to publish his notes. And that's the end we ever hear of this manuscript. Now, what's interesting is this, is as soon as he comes back to the United States, he goes to the stenographer and starts publishing preparing an anti-Soviet book. My thesis here is that probably the original plan for Oswald was to have become an anti-communist. A phony anti-communist, and the way you do that, of course, to write an anti-communist book. You know, I was in Russia, and I would say how horrible it was. Then he would infiltrate into right-wing organizations and speak from podiums and, you know, describe his adventures there. And then, sooner or later, when the assassination would take place, he would come out of a right-wing organization. Obviously, they had changed their minds. There was a change of plan. Now, it's interesting that his change of plan followed the very next day after his visit to Mr. Paul Gregory. This sudden change of plan, and Mrs. Bates, the stenographer, offered to type up the manuscript free of charge, so it wasn't a question of money. Let me just turn to page 636 so I can describe to you how the commission reports this series of events. First of all, they split it in two parts. They've got sort of two biographies of two chronologies of Oswald in the book, one on this side and one on that side, and you've got to piece them both together. 636. Yeah, it says, on June 18th, 4 days after he arrived in Fort Worth, Oswald went to the office of Mrs. Pauline Virginia Bates, a public stenographer whose name he had found in the telephone directory, and asked her to type a manuscript from the scraps of paper on which he had recorded his impressions of the Soviet Union. Intrigued by this tale that he had just returned from the Soviet Union and had smuggled his notes out of that country, that's what he told her, that he had smuggled his notes out of the country, yet he left in perfect, you know, open conditions, she agreed to type the notes for $1 per page or $2 an hour, 50 cents less than her usual hourly rate. On that day and the succeeding 2 days, Mrs. Bates spent 8 hours typing for Oswald while he remained in her office helping her with the notes and translating portions of them, which were in Russian. Well, of course, that's false because he spent only Monday in her office. Tuesday he was with Peter Gregory, and Wednesday he withdrew the manuscript. So he never spent that day and 2 succeeding days, you see. And that you can only figure out by working out this chronology, you see. At the end of each section, he collected his notes at the end of each session. How many sessions were there? We really can't figure this out. He collected his notes and as much of the manuscripts as she had done and took them away with him. On June 20th, that is Wednesday, he gave Mrs. Bates $10 for the 10 completed pages, and 10 pages are not very much, you know, you can do that less than say. He told her that he had no more money and refused to accept her offer to postpone payments or continue the work for nothing. You see. And then he goes, Oswald told Mrs. Bates that there was an engineer in Fort Worth who wanted to help him publish his notes. You see. On June 19th, he had called Peter Gregory, a petroleum engineer who was born in Siberia and taught Russian at the Fort Worth Public Library as a civic enterprise. You see. So it's quite interesting, this link, because Peter Gregory is very important in the link between Oswald and this so-called Russian community in the Dallas area, in which you will find some very interesting characters. Another interesting sequence of events which the commission talks about and which doesn't make sense unless you try to figure it out is when Oswald moved from Fort Worth to Dallas. And I want to tell you how that happened. Now, let me describe it to you in the report here and then read you the sequence of events, and you can see how the commission just about made it impossible for anyone to figure out what was going on unless you figured it out for yourself. They say, this was after they had gotten their apartment in Fort Worth, and then suddenly they moved to Dallas in October. It says, on a weekend afternoon early in October, they don't identify the date, the Oswalds were visited by his mother and a number of people from the Russian community, including George Bowie, Anna Mella, the Halls, the Demornschilds, and the Taylors. Oswald had apparently decided to look for a new job and discussed his lack of job prospects and the fact that his rent was overdue. He was advised to seek employment in the Dallas area. Elena Hall invited Marina to move into her house in Fort Worth until Oswald found a job in Dallas. She accepted the proposal, and Mrs. Hall moved Marina, her daughter June, and the Oswald's few household goods in a pickup truck belonging to the dental laboratory where she was employed. Oswald worked at the Leslie Welding Company on Monday, October 8th, but failed to appear on the following day. He was already in Dallas, you see. Now, this is interesting. What is this early weekend? This weekend afternoon early in October? Well, October 1st is a Monday. And your weekend started on October 5th, Friday, October 6th, Saturday, and October 7th, Sunday. Now, the Oswalds visited, the Oswalds had to be visited by these people on the weekend of the 5th, and the 6th, and the 7th, that is, October 6th and 7th, Saturday and Sunday, Saturday or Sunday. Now, on October 8th, that is Monday morning, Marina has already moved out overnight. These people have convinced her to move, you see. On Monday, Oswald worked at the Leslie Welding Company. On Tuesday, he failed to report for work and had simply quit his job. So in other words, he had a job. He hadn't lost the job. He just quit his job. Now here they give the reason. They say, Oswald had apparently decided to look for a new job and discussed his lack of job prospects and the fact that his rent was overdue. Now, if your rent is overdue, do you quit your job? It's rather odd that he would, you know, make this move to Dallas and have to look for a job when he already had a job. They use this as an excuse to explain his move to Dallas, that he had to look for a job. But he had a job. And they say, well, his rent was overdue. Now, when your rent is overdue, you don't quit your job and look for a new job. And this is what they pull over on us constantly throughout this report. And the only way you can possibly untangle this is to do a very, very straightforward chronology of what was going on. So much more I couldn't even begin to scratch the surface. And that would go also for the testimony as it exists in the volumes themselves. That is the full testimony, Marina's full testimony, Oswald's mother's full testimony, and the testimony of the friends who knew him in Dallas. This group, I think, is a very important group. Very little emphasis has been put on them because, obviously, Oswald's contact with the KGB was in that little Russian community, probably. I don't know what Mr. Gregory's part in it was, but it's certainly very suspect. But we have this throughout the commission report. Now, it's very interesting when you think of the murder of the President of the United States and the commission that was appointed to investigate the crime. And it begins to make a little more sense when you look into the backgrounds of some of these men. You know, Earl Warren, Chief Justice of the United States, is such a great investigator. You know, his own father was murdered in 1938. And he was in charge of the investigation of his own father's death. And it's something very interesting. You can make a comparative study between the two types of investigations. His own father's murder was never solved, and the investigation was quietly forgotten. And yet he was in charge of that investigation. He seems to have developed a peculiar skill, you see, for not solving important crimes. And this is one crime that he didn't solve. Another interesting matter is Mr. McCloy. Now, Mr. McCloy, John J. McCloy, who was one of the members of the commission, of course, is the chairman of the board of the Council on Foreign Relations. He's the top man of the Council on Foreign Relations. And you would wonder something, why they chose a man like, say, that Warren, who had been to Russia, you know, who had a vacation with his trip, and Mr. McCloy, who had also had his little vacation with his trip. I found this in the July 26, 1961 edition of the New York Times, when McCloy was over there in Russia, supposedly negotiating on disarmament, and there was this item in the newspaper. It says, Khrushchev calls McCloy for talk. May raise Berlin problem with the U.S. disarmament advisor Stokey, and described how Mr. McCloy flew to Stokey Tuesday with Mrs. McCloy and their daughter Ellen and Sharman Douglas, Mrs. McCloy's niece. The McCloy party stayed at a villa on the coast near the one occupied by Soviet premier. At 10 a.m. yesterday, Mr. Khrushchev made a 15-minute motorboat ride to the McCloy villa and brought the McCloy party back to Pitsunda. Mr. Khrushchev donned a pair of black swimming trunks and joined Mr. McCloy for swims in the pool at his villa and in the Black Sea. The two men also walked in the garden and talked. Now here is a documented account of the head of the Council on Foreign Relations and the head of the communist world having a private conversation, which no one ever overheard, in a garden. What was said together, we'll never know. But yet, there it is. It was in the newspaper. They went swimming together and then had a walk in the garden. top man of the CSR, who was later on the Warren Commission, and the truth set himself. So that's the kind of thing we've been up against. Of course, you know, the other members of the commission, Alan Dulles, head of our so-called CIA, or our CIA, Hale Boggs, notorious left-winger from Louisiana, and of course, one of the investigators they hired was Norman Redlich, Professor Norman Redlich, who has a very, very substantial pro-communist record. These are the kind of people who were appointed to investigate this murder, and of course, the reason why was quite obvious. They had to cover up what was going on, particularly in this Dallas area. And they did it, and the American people followed it. And anyone who says anything to the contrary is a theory monger. Well, that's the job we have ahead of us. We can't let them get away with it. Despite the fact that they pulled their fangs off of us and gave us a clean bill of health, so to speak, the truth is still the truth. I mean, we ought to pursue this to the very end because it's most important. I think it'll wake up more Americans than anything else. Because this indicates, this is a fantastic example of the complicity of the men in high places with this whole conspiracy. Well, anyway, I hope I've been able to enlighten you a bit on this. We could go on for days on this subject. Thank you very much.